This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Right, hello, yes, here we go again. Welcome to the Fun Kids Science Weekly. This is the show where we ask the three W's. Why do things happen? Where do things happen? And when are we going to learn about all the epic, amazing, dangerous stuff? In a little bit, because today we're talking about the most destructive volcanic eruption in the last 2.5 million years. Also, I've got a way that you can help save the world just by getting online, clicking a few buttons. It's dead easy. And next, we'll spin the Fun Kids shout-out wheel, see who's getting a hello on the show today. First, let's catch up with Marina Ventura. This is from her Climate Explorers series, where she's telling us why the weather around us works the way it does.
Marina Ventura's Climate Explorers.
Hi there. Marina Ventura here. Now, as we've been finding out, when you hear the words weather and climate, you might think they mean the same thing, but they're quite different. Isn't that right, Mappy?
Hi, Marina. Yes, that's correct. It might be rainy today or it might be sunny. That's the weather. But climate is the pattern of weather in a place over a much longer time.
And different parts of the world have very different patterns of weather. Why is that?
The Earth's climate is driven by energy from the sun, which arrives in the form of heat. Half of this energy travels through our atmosphere and reaches the Earth's surface. The other half is either absorbed by the atmosphere or reflected back into space. Because the Earth is a sphere, the sun's rays reach the Earth's surface in polar regions at a much more slanted angle than at the equator. So, straight away, we know that the poles are colder than the equator. Now, when things aren't in balance, nature likes to even things out. So the extra energy at the equator needs to be spread across the planet. And it's this that creates different climate zones across the world. Warm air rises at the equator and moves toward the poles. Where warm, wet air rises, we get thunderstorms and tropical rainforests. And where air sinks, it stops clouds from forming. So it rains less, even making deserts.
So, Map App, how many climate zones are there and how do they differ?
Well, around the equator we have tropical climates, which are hot and humid. This is where you'll find the world's rainforests. Then there are arid or dry climates, like you'd find in deserts. Next is Mediterranean, with hot dry summers and cooler wetter winters. And then there are temperate climates.
That's what we have in the UK, isn't it? Where summers are mild and winters aren't too cold.
That's right. In areas that are a very long way from the sea, the climate is continental, with long cold winters and short hot summers. Finally, there's polar climates, which experience long periods of extreme cold.
Hang on though, I've been to countries like France and Italy in the Mediterranean, and depending upon where I am, I've experienced very different weather conditions. They have lots of snow in winter, and some of their mountains are even snow-covered all year round. But they also have beautiful beaches, great fun during the hot and dry summers. So, if you've got both snow-covered mountains and hot beaches, does that mean they don't have a Mediterranean climate?
Of course not. It just means that local climates in a country can be different to the region's climate. This can be for lots of reasons. High places, like mountains, tend to be colder because the air is cooler the higher you go. Vegetation can also affect the local climate we experience. In equatorial rainforests, dense vegetation blocking the wind, combined with high temperatures and rainfall, means it's a very humid place to be. Where there's no vegetation, the air can be much drier and the wind can blow. In busy cities, the air temperature is often warmer than the surrounding countryside, particularly at nighttime. This is due to buildings and roads absorbing heat during the day and giving it off at night. Another thing that can affect a local climate is the wind. It might be that part of a country frequently catches wind from another region. This is called a prevailing wind. If it's coming from a hotter place, this might raise temperatures. Or if it's from a colder area, it will cause the local temperature to drop.
I think I want to be back on the beach. This wind's coming from a very cold place. Lovely. Time for a dip.
Even the oceans have a part to play in influencing our weather and climate.
As we shall find out later. Thanks, Mappy. And just because a place has one climate doesn't mean it won't change. Climate scientists take measurements over long periods of time to track patterns in temperature and rainfall. These help us know what to expect today and in the future, but are also a great way to see what changes have happened in the past. Amazing to think that 20,000 years ago, the UK would have been in the Ice Age, and our climate here would have been similar to the polar climates that we see today. Cold enough to have a pet polar bear. Join us next time when we'll be finding out about how and why climates change.
Marina Ventura's Climate Explorers, supported by the Natural Environment Research Council, the science of the natural world. Find out more at funkidslive.com/marina.
Why don't you download all of Marina Ventura's Climate Explorers episodes? Then you can catch up with them whenever you fancy. Save it to your phone or tablet. You can do that on the free Fun Kids app, on your favourite podcast place, you know, like iTunes, and you can listen over at funkidslive.com. We're talking to the director from the charity The Plastic Tide in just a sec, all about how he's using drones to help save our seas. First, let's give a spin to the Fun Kids shout-out wheel in the studio. It's covered with names of the people who have given this show a review on the iTunes podcast store. And whoever it lands on once I've spun it gets a hello, dead simple. Right, I've spun it. It's gone past Table Tennis Master again, second week in a row. Also, George and Tom and Lucy and Ben, it's landing on Beth. Hello, Beth. You've written in as AG Brit fan, and she says that she loves the show and that her favourite part is Dangerous Dan. Brilliant news, Beth. Here's a secret. It's my favourite part as well. That's why I named it after myself. I know, a little bit smug of me, but it's my show. What can you do? Now, today's Dangerous Dan, it's all about a volcanic eruption that caused a winter that lasted on Earth for around 10 years. It made the world a little bit like Narnia, I guess. Thank you so much for getting in touch, Beth, and for dropping us 5 stars. Now, if you want a shout-out, you need to get your name on the spinning wheel in the studio. To do that, find the Fun Kids Science Weekly on the iTunes podcast store and leave us a review. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, this week, we're tackling a problem that is threatening the very planet that we live on. Peter Curler is from the charity The Plastic Tide, and he's here to tell us more about what's really going on in the ocean. Peter, hello, welcome to the show.
Hi, everyone.
So, spell it out for us then. How bad has this problem really got in the sea?
It's gotten pretty bad. So I think the last quote we thought there were 5 trillion pieces of plastic in our ocean from all kinds of sizes. Because some scientists have done some more estimations, and we think that is now an underestimate. So 5 trillion pieces. That's probably more grains grains of sand on a beach. It's incredible. It's scary.
Isn't there the statistic that as humans and scientists, we only know about 5% of what's in the ocean anyway?
Yeah.
There's about 95% that's completely unknown to us.
Yeah.
So maybe the problem's going even further. So why is this happening? Why is all this plastic floating around our ocean? And a lot of people, apart from charities such like yourselves, aren't doing much about it.
See, I think we're only just starting to understand the problem now. I think we just haven't known about it before. I think research has been going on, and it's only now that the big picture is dawning on us, and it's a result of the way we live. So we see plastic in everything we do. I mean, and if you look at what you're doing, whatever you're touching now, even your phone is made of plastic. And it's not to say that we need to get rid of all of the plastic. It's just how we manage it. That's the problem. And I think a lot of science is sort of pointing to that direction, that mismanagement means that it spills into the ocean. Maybe, you know, if you throw a piece of litter on the ground, the next rainstorm that comes along, it could get washed into the ocean via a drain. So if people aren't careful with what they do with their litter, there's a very good chance it will end up in the sea.
What happens to it when it's in there? Why is this such an issue?
So when it gets into the sea, it breaks down into tiny, tiny little pieces of plastic called microplastics. But even before then, when it's in large pieces of plastic, like, for example, fishing nets, ropes, strings, what happens is it can look like food to a lot of animals. So a lot of marine animals will come and try and eat it. So, for example, I think we've all seen on Blue Planet 2 the whale playing with a bucket. Now, we're finding that a lot of whales and larger mammals washing up on beaches have stomachs full of plastic. We see a lot of seals entangled in ropes and plastics because they play with it, they toy with it, because they're naturally fun animals. They like to play with things, inquisitive.
How bad can this get? So right now there's all these tiny little bits of plastic floating around. What can the long-term damage to the Earth be?
So, and this is why it's so important. It's being covered by British Science Week, and why we're trying to get so many tags in on this. But what we only have one ocean, so it's not like your phone. You can't go and buy a new one. You can't change the ocean. These trillions of tiny pieces of plastic are almost impossible to remove, right? So what can happen is that it can build up to levels where it gets stuck in fish and fish will eat it. Then we eat the fish. And so we're eating our own rubbish. Quite literally, we're eating our own rubbish. And we don't yet know what damage that can do to us.
So you're the founder of the Plastic Tide, a charity that's looking to help this problem. How are you starting? What are you doing right now?
So the biggest thing is that when it enters our ocean, 99% of the plastic is unaccounted for. What started with me is I went to the South Pacific and I saw firsthand the plastics that are affecting these in the very remote islands, thousands of miles away from major cities. So when I understood the problem more, I could see that we needed to monitor that plastic. We need to detect, we need to identify where it is, and only then can we sort of trace it back and say, okay, well, that's a big source. You know, if we're getting lots of bottles in of certain types, then we know that that's almost like a tap, if you will, that we can turn off on land to stop all of that plastic getting into the sea. So before it even gets into the sea, we can prevent it through this work that the Plastic Tide does through tagging plastics online. But also, it can help make beach cleans much more targeted and make sure that we can identify the hot spots on coastlines where plastic litter builds up. So if ever you see any litter on the beach, please clean it up. And if you can't get to the beach, then you can log on online to theplastictide.com and then click our target link. Our new target is 1 million pieces. So we're looking for 1 million tags. And each one of those tags trains a machine learning algorithm or a computer program to find plastics by itself automatically. So if you imagine we can send out thousands of these digital eyes all over the coastlines to find the plastic for us and to tell us how much is building up and where. And through that, we can generate this global picture of the plastic problem in a way that we've never been able to do before. And all of it depends on people tagging the plastics to train the computer program.
And is this where drones come into the mixture? I've heard some talk with the Plastic Tide and drones. Is that what's going on?
So what we do, we get a drone, and it can be any drone that you can buy off the shelf. You do need to make sure you've got the proper license and the permissions to do it. But you can fly to a beach and you survey the beach. And then when we're done, we upload those images to the Zooniverse platform, this tagging platform that I've just been telling you about. So all the little images you see in that platform on that website are from our drone. And we've also starting to bring in images from other drones around the world. And eventually, when we've tagged it all, we then the algorithm would automatically be able to find the plastics in any of the images taken from any drone.
How can we make sure the problem doesn't go further? What can we do that's not technological? We don't need to go online to do it.
Yeah.
What can we do right now to stop plastic getting into the ocean to cause any issue?
So you right there, you have, on sitting on your desk, you have a reusable water bottle. That's number one. If you drink coffee, if you're old enough, you can get a reusable coffee cup. Reusable items, simple things like that are very easy to do. You can ask your mum and dad. It saves you money in the long run. There are more and more refillable water fountains cropping up in London. Don't flush anything down the toilet that isn't natural. Any wet wipes say it's flushable, it's not. Because they don't break down, they're made of plastic. And you wouldn't think they are, but they are made of plastic. And it says flushable, but they're not flushable.
Then where do we go? So the Plastic Tide, where can I go online? Where can I tag things for you? Where can I be the 1 millionth person?
You can go to www.theplastictide, all one word.com, and you log in there and you'll see underneath, you'll see a tag it button. Click on that tag it button and it'll take you to our tagging website. Or you can follow us at The Plastic Tide on Twitter, or The Plastic Tide on Facebook, or at Vision from the Skies on Instagram. Also check out the British Science Association website. We've always publishing stuff about how we're doing and our progress, and thanking everyone. And tell us what you're doing as well. If you're tagging, please let us know, and let us know what you find, if you find anything cool.
Well, there's so many ways there that you can help save the world, like almost exactly. quite literally. Peter, thank you not just for coming in and telling us that, but you've made me feel very smug as Good. Well with my reusable water bottle. So I'll go and tell everybody that now. Peter Curler, thank you so much from the Plastic Tide for coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly.
Thank you, everyone.
It's time for this week's Dangerous Dan, then, where we have a look at the most amazingly deadly, mean and cruel things in the universe. Today, we're travelling back in time. 74,000 years ago, approximately, precisely, to take a look at one of the most powerful volcanic eruptions ever. Mount Toba was a gigantic volcano in Indonesia, and 74,000 years ago, it exploded with such force, it's known as a supervolcano. It was 100 times greater and stronger than the most recent super eruption, which was like almost over 200 years ago now, in 1815, and it is believed to be the most powerful eruption in 2.5 million years. And Mount Toba, it spewed ash and fire and lava into the sky, and the ash cloud it formed covered much of the earth, sending us into darkness. And many scientists think that this event caused a volcanic winter, where the ash blocks out the sun and it makes the planet drastically colder. And that's not all. The gigantic crater that it blew through the earth has now formed a lake which you can visit. It's called Lake Toba. And recently, though, scientists, they've said that they don't think this dented the human population as much as once thought, that we actually survived it quite well. But still, come on, a furious eruption of ash into the air which caused a winter that lasted maybe 10 years? That's pretty dangerous. So I've got a win-win for you in just a sec. It's a way that you can get a shout-out on this show, and also you can get that really annoying science question that's nagging your brain answered by someone that really knows their stuff. First, let's get into our Age of the Dinosaurs series. We're travelling back in time, looking at what they ate.
Travel back in time to the Age of the Dinosaur
at the Natural History Museum.
Imagine going back in time, not 100 years or 1,000 years, but millions of years. To the Age of the Dinosaur. Welcome to the Jurassic period, which was between 145 and 200 million years ago. It was a time when plant life began to flourish once again, as newly formed oceans brought rain to many parts of the world that had previously been nothing more than dry deserts.
Phew, it's really hot here.
Vast, humid forests covered much of the land. But unlike the forests you see today, the Jurassic forests were full of giant ferns and tall leafy green conifers, similar to monkey puzzle trees and giant redwoods. Under this towering canopy were smaller leafy plants similar to the ferns and horsetails that we see today. Plants weren't yet producing colourful flowers to attract insects. Instead, many produced cones full of seeds and pollen, or tiny capsules containing spores. It therefore wasn't a time to stop and pick a bunch of blooms. Not that you'd want to, with some of the animals around.
Uh-oh, something's coming.
With trees taller than houses, dinosaurs were built to match. Huge sauropods, some reaching more than 12 meters high, and others over 30 meters in length, roam the forests, reaching up high with their long necks to eat the rough leaves at the top of the tallest branches. Many lived and traveled in large herds, which helped ward off predators.
Whoa, look at that one, it's huge.
Ah yes, that's a Camarasaurus. Brachiosaurus and Camarasaurus were two sauropods you'd find in a Jurassic forest. Both were huge quadrupeds, meaning four-legged animals, with small heads but long necks and large bodies. The Camarasaurus had enormous chisel-shaped teeth that could be nearly 15 centimeters long, and they helped him to chew his food, something not all sauropods could do. Don't worry, they wouldn't be interested in chewing you and me. As vegetarians, they'd rather have some tasty leaves.
Quick, he's looking for more leaves. Duck!
Paleontology. Pick.
Fossils help us understand what dinosaurs were like, but scientists didn't really start to examine fossils until only 200 years ago.
Do you know how a fossil is made? After the soft parts of an animal have been eaten or rotted away, the hard parts, like the skeleton, became covered in silt, sand, or earth. Over time, these layers became deeper, and water flowing slowly through the rock brought minerals that started to replace the bone bit by bit. Eventually, these minerals totally replaced the original bony skeleton with an exact replica in rock, and therefore preserved for fossil explorers to discover millions of years later. Prehistoric animals and plant life can also be found in amber, which is formed when a sticky resin from trees sets hard. Scientists have found insects trapped inside amber, perfectly preserved for us to see today. Travel back in time to the age of the dinosaur.
The new interactive exhibition at the Natural History Museum. Walk alongside life-size moving animatronic dinosaurs and other strange creatures among the smells and sounds of the prehistoric Jurassic swamps and Cretaceous deserts. Find out more at nhm.ac.uk.
But watch out for what's around the corner.
Remember, I'm after your questions, a nice big bundle of them, of loads of science stuff that you want to know about. So then I can put them all to our science expert. They're coming in really soon. So if there's something that's nagging your brain, you know, something that maybe you've read online and you just don't think it can possibly be true and it's more fake news, ugh. Or maybe it's something that you were told by a science teacher at school and they're meant to be proper smart as well, but it just doesn't make sense to you. Well, here's the thing. I can get it answered by a proper science expert. They're coming into the studio to answer them really soon, but I need your questions. Let me know what you want answered right now over on our page, funkidslive.com, or on the free Fun Kids app. We'll find out what you do when you need to spew in space in just a sec. First, let's catch up with all the science in the news this week. And scientists have calculated one of the most dangerous temperatures in the water. 22 degrees Celsius is the preferred temperature of the tiger shark. Loads of studies have gone into this, and it turns out 22 degrees C makes these sharks more active, it brings more of them out and about, and ultimately, it makes them try and snack on more humans in the sea. Also, staying in the sea, coral reefs are under threat if the carbon dioxide levels continue to rise at their predicted rate. You see, when CO2 dissolves into the ocean, it raises the acidity level in there in the sea, which can damage coral fatally. Yet another reason why we need to reduce CO2 levels to save the planet. And finally, wildlife experts are warning of the risks of feeding birds in your garden because it's not always healthy for them. The birds that carry diseases, they spread to other birds. And if they all meet around the feeders in your garden to snack, it can be very deadly to them because things like bird pox and salmonella, they seem to be spreading from bird to bird on these meetings in your garden snacking. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Time to catch up with Professor Pulsar then. He is our intergalactic genius, telling us about what really goes on in the dark depths of the universe. And now, imagine this. Okay, oh, very quickly, I need some spacey music. There we go. Imagine this. You're floating around in space, coming near Venus. And suddenly, you need to vomit. What do you do?
Professor Pulsar's Space Explanation Service with support from the UK Space Agency. Somewhere between Polaris and Ursa Minor, just a glint in the night sky to the naked eye. But look a little closer, and you will see it is Professor Pulsar's exploration craft, the Intrepid 5, piloted by trusted Captain T. Torrey. While the pupils of Deep Space High take their school holidays, Pulsar is roaming the universe to explore the most dastardly difficult mysteries of space and broadcasting his findings back to the planets. It can only be another episode of Professor Pulsar's Space Explanation Service.
Goodness me, Professor. It feels like light years since we've had a question. Maybe we've finally solved all the mysteries of space.
Don't be ridiculous, Captain T. Torrey. We could be out here for another million years and still wouldn't even have scratched the surface. Space is pretty vast, you know. Why don't we check the space mail and see if anything has come in overnight?
You have one new message.
I get car sick. Can you get spicy?
Mmm. space sick? That sounds like a potentially messy question. Let's get some expert advice to see if we can clear it up.
Connecting. Please identify yourself.
My name is Tim Peake, and I'm a British astronaut with the European Space Agency.
So, Tim, you're going into space in 2015 as part of the Principia mission to the International Space Station. You used to be a test pilot, so surely you won't get space sick, will you?
Do you know, that's a very good question. I'm almost certain I will get space sick at some point. It happens to most astronauts, and they never really know when it's going to happen. Even fast jet test pilots who are very used to, you know, pulling lots of G in jets, they still get space sick. So there's no real relation to car sickness or seasickness or air sickness. Space sickness is fairly unique.
Well, that doesn't sound very pleasant. Captain Titore, see if you can throw up any more information.
Oh, Professor.
Right. I think I've found someone. We're focusing on England and the UK Space Agency. I will see what the computer can bring up.
No more sickness jokes. Loading intel. The UK Space Agency is a government organisation who represent the UK space industry to the rest of the world. One of the UK Space Agency's recent programmes is the design and launch of CubeSat, a miniature cube-shaped satellite that will allow the UK to test cutting-edge new technologies in space. Expert identified. Patching call through to flight deck.
Very good. Who's on the line?
My name is Libby Jackson. I work for the UK Space Agency.
So, Libby, what do you know about space sickness?
Astronauts do get space sick. When you first go into space, you cannot feel the effects of gravity anymore. And so all the blood and fluid in your body that's usually sort of dragged down to your feet because of gravity equalizes out. And that makes you feel sick, basically. So it's a very similar feeling. Astronauts, they feel better after a few days. They get used to the new environment and then they are fine. But they do get space sick for a few days.
Well, well, well. Getting that one answered has certainly settled my stomach. Let's get this ship pointing in the right direction for our next question. And no sudden turns, Captain Titore. I'm feeling quite queasy.
Firing starboard thrusters, Professor.
Professor Pulsar's Space Explanation Service, with support from the UK Space Agency. Continue your space exploration at funkidslive.com/deepspacehigh.
You can get all our Deep Space High series for free right now for your phone or tablet. Get to the free Fun Kids app, wherever you download your podcast from, and also at funkidslive.com. And those places are the best places for you to catch up on all of our brilliant Fun Kids Science series. I'll go through them one more time to really jam it into your brain. The free Fun Kids app, wherever you get your podcast from, you know, places like iTunes, and at funkidslive.com, and get all of our science series on there. And remember, you can listen to Fun Kids wherever you are in the country. Just get to your DAB digital radio, get to that free Fun Kids app, and you can always have a listen at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.